Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Bolt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, and my latest book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. Jules Michelet, born 21 August 1798, was a French historian and writer. He's best known for his multi-volume work, Histoire de France, which traces the history of France from the earliest times to the French Revolution. He's considered one of the founders of modern historiography. Michelet was influenced by Jean-Baptiste Vico. He admired Vico's emphasis on the role of people and their customs in shaping history, which was a major departure from the emphasis on political and military leaders. Michelet also drew inspiration from Vico's concept of the coursi et recoursi, or the cyclical nature of history, in which societies rise and fall in a recurring pattern. According to Michelet, medieval witchcraft was an act of popular rebellion against the oppression of feudalism and the Roman Catholic Church. This rebellion took the form of a secret religion inspired by paganism and belief in fairies, organized by a woman who became its leader. The participants in the religion met regularly at witch sabbats and black masses. Michelet's account dwells on the suffering of peasants and women in the Middle Ages and writes that history should concentrate on the people and not only its leaders or its institutions, putting him ahead of his time as a writer of microhistory. Michelet was one of the first people to attempt to give a sociological explanation of the witch trials and interprets the source material very literally. According to Michelet, in a note added at the end of the book, the object of my book was purely to give not a history of sorcery, but a simple and impressive formula of the sorceress's way of life, which my learned predecessors darkened by the very elaboration of their scientific methods and the excess of detail. My strong point is to start not from the devil, from an empty conception, but from a living reality, the sorceress, a warm, breathing reality, rich in results and possibilities. Upon his death from a heart attack at Yar on 9 February 1874, Michelet was interred there. At his widow's request, a Paris court granted permission for his body to be exhumed on the 13th of May, 1876, in order for him to be buried in Paris. On the 16th of May, his coffin arrived for reburial at Le Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. Michelet's monument there, designed by architect Jean-Louis Pascal, was erected in 1893 through public subscription. And all that is available from Wikipedia. And then I have a little bit about the book that we are going to talk about today. And this is the book that we are discussing today is La Sorcière, which is usually not listed on Michelet's bios. It was kind of dismissed in his time and dismissed later. And this section about the book is from Satanism, a Reader, edited by Per Fonald. And I apologize, I do not know how to pronounce his name. And Johan Nielsen, published in 2023, chapter 3, Jules Michelet, La Sorcière, published 1862. And that chapter was written by Ruben von Vuick. Almost directly after its appearance, La Sorcière was banned by the French authorities, eliciting letters of support by both George Sand and Victor Hugo, and making the work an immediate succès du scandale. It was reprinted repeatedly and translated in most major European languages, including English. The English translation actually came out the year after it was published in French. Despite its highly fanciful nature, Michelet's book remained an often cited source on the history of witchcraft during the rest of the 19th century. Directly or indirectly, it influenced important figures in the history of Satanism as Joris Karl Wiesmann, Jules Bois, and Polish decadent Stanisław Perbaszewski, who had been dubbed as one of the first modern Satanists by scholar Per Fano. Michelet was also an unacknowledged source of inspiration for Charles Godfrey, Leland, and Margaret Murray, two authors who would be of great importance for the genesis of the modern pagan witchcraft movement. Michelet's hint that the witch cult might have subsisted in the remoter parts of the countryside would receive an unexpected follow-up in 1954 when an English coven of traditional, quote-unquote, witches led by Gerald Gardner came into the open. So there's a not very brief idea of who we're talking about and which of their books we're talking about today. And to talk about La Sorcière with me is Via Dara, and she's been on the show before, so I'm going to let her introduce herself and tell us why you chose this book.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me back. This is awesome. I had such fun on the last show, and I'm really happy to be back. My name is Via Hedera. For those of you who don't know, I am a folk witch. I am an author, a sculptor, and a general all-around menace. I am the author of Folkloric Witchcraft and the Multicultural Experience. I am a Los Angeles-born but Seattle-based artist and writer, and I chose Satanism and Witchcraft / La Sorcière because I believe it is not only one of the most sympathetic and accurate portrayals of the rise of witchcraft, but it's so punk rock. It's so feminist in some ways. It values the heart of folk magic in a way that I really connected with growing up. And it became a huge inspiration for me. And the more I started to look into witchcraft, the more I started to find that it was a huge inspiration for the entirety of what we know of traditional witchcraft today. A lot of these resources pulled from Jules Michelet's work and from his ideas. And I found that so fascinating and found his portrayal of the witch as a sympathetic punk rock rebel so inspiring and accurate that it became an instant favorite for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, just reading about Michelet. So this is the first time I had read this. I was joking with Via before we started recording that I have COVID brain. So like getting into even reading it in the English translation, like it's so flowery compared to modern language, especially it's in two books. And the first book is kind of the storytelling part, and we'll get into that. And the second book is kind of more about facts of witch trials in the Middle Ages. But also, you know, Michelet was really kind of so wrapped up in the history in France because he was alive during the revolution or kind of the dregs of the revolution, I guess. You know, he lost his job at the university during one of the Napoleons, you know, and was also the scholar who kind of named it the Renaissance and really talked about the break between medieval thought or the Middle Ages and Renaissance thought. So, I mean, it's a pretty important historian, but yet this book is often not mentioned in his work because at the time, it was kind of shunned as a polemic against the government more than even talking about witchcraft. It was really seen as a polemic against the government. And later he was kind of refuted as not having good scholarship. So it's kind of an interesting book, but yeah, let's get into that. So do you want to kind of talk about how the book is broken down and kind of what the two parts are?
Well, you pretty much got it right. It's a two-part book. The first part is a beautiful poetic prose that's following the story of what is becoming a woman that's becoming a witch, a sorceress, a woman that has been belittled and degraded and harmed and impoverished and is now seeking this new way of life. She's been called to this new sense of soul and self and discovery of her own power. And as she does, she starts to notice that even the trees bend to her, the wind bends to her, the animals speak to her, and the plants say, gather me, gather me. And she starts to, the more she explores this inner power that she's been denied her whole life, and the more she embraces this gift, which is, you know, framed as a gift from the devil, who's also relatively in some ways benevolently portrayed in the story mm-hmm. to some degree, at least for her. And the first part of the book sort of tells this story, this evolution of the woman who really just represents what a witch, how witchcraft emerges, how this rebellion emerges because of oppression, because of repression. And the second part of the book is really fascinating information that I had a lot of fun with because you have to take a lot of what he researched with a grain of salt, but a lot of it's about the church's reactionary it's just the reactionaryism of the church about the people that they the people that they persecuted, the people they accused, the trials that sort of, by the time you finish the book, you start to realize that the unfairness and the oppression is circling back here to say that this witchcraft will rise because of oppression. It will rise from the deaths of these innocents. It will rise from these trials that are nonsensical. It is a highly political end to a book that started off very poetic and almost fantastical, mm-hmm. and circles back to why this rebellion would be inevitable, why people would turn to the devil if what God is presenting is this criminality of thought and of feminine behavior or of otherness. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting split. I have to say, I think most people would agree that the first part is the story of the sorceress is the fun part.
Yeah.
But when you're trying to sort of back up where he was coming from and why he would even bother wanting to tell this narrative, you have to sort of read the last part and understand what he was seeing and dealing with at that time and the ridiculousness of these heresy trials and this perception of the poor and the other as inherently evil and ruled by evil. And so it's pretty fascinating breakdown, but the first part's definitely the funnest.
Yeah. And it is really, you're right. It's really beautiful. And I mean, I think the thing that was interesting reading it is, you know, anytime you're reading kind of archaic language, it takes a little while to get into the flow. And then once you do, like the story is, it's interesting to me in the dichotomy of the two sections, because in the first section, you're right, like her witchcraft cons really from oppression from like the feudal system. Yeah. And like the lady of the manor, who is depicted as very corrupt in her own way, but right. also jealous of this village serf woman who's beautiful.
Right.
And then kind of rains down stuff on her because she's jealous of her and all of this, you know, and really all she wants is to have a decent life and for them not to murder her husband. I mean, like it's her wishes initially are pretty simple.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, juxtaposing that to the second part where the oppressor is really viewed as the Catholic Church and shown as incredibly corrupt, and about these stories, especially, gosh, so there's so many of them that he tells in that second part where the character, I guess, you know, the main actor in the story is usually an incredibly young girl or woman.
Yeah.
Who is corrupted by the church. I mean, there's really no way to say it. They're used and abused by someone in power in the church, and they either go mad or they take the revenge in the form of accusing that person of witchcraft. So.
Right. I loved how rebellious Jules was. I love that this mm-hmm. was a very not even veiled. I could see why he got in trouble at the time. It wasn't even veiled. He was very clearly saying that you can't, this rebellion, this riot is the voice of the oppressed and the quiet. And that I love that it was symbolized in such a classic motif, which is the young woman who gets corrupted into witchcraft and discovers her power because it's just a step too far today. Mm-hmm. I love that idea of a witch is just a person who's about one step away from a real bad day and making it everybody else's problem.
Nice.
I loved it. And I loved that he did not frame his sympathies around the church because he shouldn't have had sympathies for the church. The church didn't have sympathies for him or the people at the time, but he had such great sympathy for the country folk, for the impoverished, for those who are on the fringes of society, that you can really see the sympathy throughout the narrative that he has for oppressed youth and women.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the time, like, especially for his time, like if we couch it in context, like you said, it is incredibly feminist in talking about women's power. There is some kind of essentialism about women because the witches and the sorceress is always depicted as female. Right. And then the wizards are like these corrupt parts of the Catholic Church, which is kind of an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah.
And there's a couple moments in there where like, oh yeah, you're of your time. He clearly has something about what he like the Japanese or something. And then there's also some things about, you know, people from the West Indies. There's like some not great stuff in there, but I think and he doesn't dwell on it. They're kind of throwaway comments.
Right.
But it also reveals his own prejudice of the time, I guess. But
right.
I thought the part about women was especially interesting because that was incredibly forward thinking, despite the essentialist nature of it. It was pretty forward of him. And apparently was true in other parts of his life, that he really supported the women in his life. And, you know.
Yeah, I try not to, when I read old stuff, which is mostly all I read, almost nothing ever really offends me, because I am looking at it from the point of view of where these people were, the language they were using, the time frame. It's, you know, those distinctions in semantics and in biases and in thoughts, they change, and they don't necessarily reflect that this person was corrupt or ignorant or irredeemable. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that I've said or we say during our time that I'm absolutely certain in 50 years time we'll be told was incredibly insensitive.
Yeah.
Words that were absolutely fine to use are now not okay language. Thoughts that were once considered commonplace are no longer that. And the point is that we evolve past it. I try not to ever erase that from my knowledge when I'm mm-hmm. working with these kinds of people, where I'm like, yeah, you're an old white man from a privileged ass place in history that I probably would not have wanted to live in for my being a woman of color. But I try to look past it at the source, because if I got caught up on all those parts, I probably wouldn't be into reading a lot of folklore and history, because mm-hmm. it's bad, racist and sexist and rapey. And there's just, it can be so negative and scary. And it's interesting because it'll change just decade ago, the language that we used.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty fascinating sometimes to read him, because I have to sit there and think very carefully about what I'm reading and the context I'm about to use his research, and the sensitivity I need to have about the fact that he was so prejudiced and biased, and that was his perspective at the time. Mm-hmm. That's always a fun thing to mess around with when you're reading history.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right. It is important to contextualize. I mean, you know, there are, and I think I've talked about this on the show with someone else. I mean, there are folks in history that were problematic in their own time, like Christopher Columbus, like even his peers were like, dude, you're too much. Like, you need to tamp it down. And then there are people like Michelet, who was actually very progressive for his time, but still has some of these things that would evolve over time.
Right.
And we can't know what he would be like were he alive today. We can only base on what we know from his writing, and what other people had to say about him, which wasn't always good, unfortunately. I think part of that was because he was a shit stirrer.
Punk. He was just a little shit starter. He didn't give a damn what people thought. And I kind of loved it, but I also kind of, he was interesting. He was almost like a celebrity. His egotism kind of showed mm-hmm. through in a lot of places. He could be like just profoundly pretentious, but a beautiful poetic way of writing.
Mm-hmm. So for you, like, I mean, you talked about why you chose this book, but like, how does this book exist, like, in your own system of practice? Like, because we were talking before, you said you reference it a lot. So this book is kind of always at hand for you. So how does it play into your personal practice?
You know, a lot of his description of the witch is precisely how I view the folk witch narrative, and very much how I view myself. There's like a specific quote in there that reminds me of the feeling that I get during my practice as a witch. And the fact that I am very much tied to traditional witchcraft, I am a practitioner of my own morally ambiguous form of practice. I'm not, you know, I don't subscribe to like a specific set tradition that exists. You know, I'm not a British traditional witch. I'm a folk witch. And I really loved the sorceress, because she was very raw and country and just sort of living her very much, just be doing her thing. And the way mm-hmm. he described her as the bride of the desert and black despair, fed on hate and vengeance, lo, she finds all these innocent creatures inviting her to smile. The trees bending before the south wind do her gentle reverence. All the grasses of the field with their diverse virtues, perfumes, healing drugs, or poisons, more often than not one and the same thing, offer themselves, murmuring, gather me, gather me. To me, that is the witch. That mm-hmm. That's me. That's my ideal, who I wanted to be, is some chick walking around gathering diverse virtues from healing drugs and poisons and living up to my own sense of values, whether that be vengeance or healing or mm-hmm. corruption. I love that she was the provider of those things, that she did what she wanted. She had this power that she gathered from the land. And in my practice, there's so much of the way he poetically describes her and describes her discovery of magic that really fits in with how I felt I discovered mm-hmm. witchcraft. When I sort of started to feel like, you know, when I got close to the land and the spirits of the land, I sort of felt that tangible connection to them where they were like, gather me, gather me. And I remember reading that line as a kid and being like, that's exactly how I feel. I'll be wandering the woods and feeling like there is just a world unseen and seen around me that is not bending to my power, but I'm part of it. And we're with each other entwined, and we're both dancing in these shadows and in the light. And I loved it. I love that even if he was framing it as part of her corruption, I don't see the devil that way. I take a very decidedly Gnostic point of view on the light bringer and the Promethean value of Lucifer, yeah. these deities of the other world and the crossroads that we refer to as the devil. To me, they're trickster deities of many varieties. So I have an innately sympathetic view that he very much seems to share in the story where, yes, there's corruption, but there's also this gift to it. Mm-hmm. The devil's a bit like a monkey's paw like that. But there was this strong influence in my childhood where I felt like this is a person who understands the necessity of the darkness that does permeate and half inhabits what witchcraft is. By its very nature is this rebellion, this seeking of the shadows, this darkness, this willingness to do what you want to do rather than what the community or society tells you to do. Because quite frankly, you know, to hell with them. Society is corrupt. The church is society. The church is corrupt. So if you want to resort to hellfire and brimstone and drugs and healing potions and wildness, I say, go for it. Hell yeah. Rebel. Live your life. Live, dance in the fires and the shadow, burn and holy, holy hell goodness. I mean, if it works for you as a witch, I say, do it. And I love that the book sort of took a sympathetic view to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it sees the witch, like he said in his note at the end, and like you point out, as really the counterpoint to this corruption of the state and church. But I think that the thing that I found so fascinating in reading it is though he calls the spirit that she deals with the devil, he also really cages it in, like, is it the fae? Is it like a vestige of the pagan gods? Like, he never really lets you go. Yes, this is Satan as written into Christian lore. This is really something that perhaps was demonized.
Yes.
So,
and I felt like that very much speaks to the way a lot of traditional witches see this narrative of the devil. And it was mm-hmm. something that I touched in my own book, where this idea of the devil as this ultimate adversary and evil isn't entirely accurate. What we're calling the devil is an amalgamation of so many different deities from different cultures that were pulled into this umbrella. And they're not all corruptors. Most of the time, these were just trickster deities, nature mm-hmm. deities. These horned gods that the church has demonized. Mm-hmm. It's so funny because they're prey animal. You know, Kernunos, the horned god with his antlers, is prey animal. Pan with his horns, it's a goat, it's a prey animal. Mm-hmm. It's not some villain, some hunter, some great thing. It's a prey beast, and it's an agricultural thing. And I love that he sort of dances around the idea that this devil might just be a evil in the eyes of the church. This could just be an mm-hmm. otherworldly spirit. It could be fairy. And that's so in keeping with traditional witchcraft, is mm-hmm. their idea of, well, what your witch father and your witch mother is in your tradition is going to be different from someone else's. Is it a hag? Is it queen of alchemy? Is he the father at the crossroads? Is he Anko? Is he the man in black or Elegua? There's so many descriptions and things people mean when they say devil or Satan or any of these figures. I really love that he didn't very much say this is the adversary, this is the great one, the great evil mm-hmm. of the religions as they've deduced it now. He's saying that this is a spirit. It's yeah. described far more in spiritual terms, which yeah. I think very much is in keeping with the value of the Witch King, not them great adversaries. I mean, it depends on what side of the you're on, exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also interesting is that there's also this interpretation that I think would be fairly easy to come away from is that the spirit is kind of her own power.
Yes.
Because she starts out, you know, oppressed by the thing, wants her husband to live. She is brought up to this person that is like the queen of the serfs in her village, basically. And she and her husband do well. Their land prospers, their animals prosper, everything prospers. And then as things start to tumble and she retreats into herself, she's left with her own power, which is either innate in her or from this spirit. And maybe there's not really an answer, yes or no there.
Yes, that was how I interpreted it. Is you don't really know. You're not sure if the spirit is simply a muse inspiring her to dig deep past all the pain and the retribution, the vengeance, the hurt, and find herself, or if it was some exterior influence. You know, it's kind of hard to tell. I always thought that the spirit really was just the spirit of a witch, the animating force that makes those of us who practice do what we want to do, that spark inside us, that fire. I thought that voice was coming from inside her. And while it might be otherworldly, it was specifically her power. It was that witchcraft inside of her trying to awaken. That's the interpretation I had, at least. Yeah.
I mean, I like that as the interpretation. And I think it's interesting, but you said something and I wanted to remember to get back to it, is reading this when you were a kid. How did you find this book?
Well, so my grandma, she was very, very Christian, super Christian, but she was an immense book collector. Now in my family, reading is, I mean, that is entertainment. Mm-hmm. That was how you were. I mean, we got read to every night until I was about like 9 years old. Reading every single day was mandatory. I didn't get through summers without completing the book list that my mom assigned to me. And I was never resentful about it because it was always, she has great taste in books. And she got it from my grandma. And my grandma, as Christian as she was, she would collect anything and everything that looked interesting. And sometimes she wouldn't really pay very close attention. She just would collect it. So she had this whole shelf of works from C.S. Lewis and from other writers. And a lot of it talking about Christian theology. She had a lot of books talking about, you know, there's very pro-Christian. And she also had books that pertain to, you know, the great evil that we should look out for, like Satanism and witches and all that. And we should know about them. And I don't think she really read The Sorceress. I think she thought that it was describing the corruption of witchcraft and that it was a resource to have. So she just had it in all of these reference books. And I was like, oh, I stumbled on it when I was like 9, 8
Wow.
Or 9. And I was reading Mere Christianity at the time by C.S. Lewis. And then I was looking through the shelf and I see this, you know, I see all of her taboo ones, the ones about the evil stuff, you know, and I started reading it and was like, I think I'm missing something because this sounds awesome. This sounds fun. This sounds we do in my household when I'm not visiting you. You know, it sounds a lot closer to the magic that I'm growing up with when I'm not having to visit my grandparents. And so I wound up actually inheriting, like, I don't know, God, like 50 of her books. And I very discreetly took that one, a bunch of her herbalism books that she didn't know had a bunch of magical notes in them. I took anything that I was like, I don't think she even appreciates what she's got here. So now I've got this whole shelf beside me of her collection of Reader Digest and her Edgar Allan Poe poetry collection and her book of The Sorceress. So that's how I came across it. Is I had an awesome library based family, and in their libraries they never quite knew what they always had, but I always did. I was stuck there reading them.
Yeah. I'm just so grateful to people who are like that, though, that have personal libraries, because I think I know so many people who came to find them their true selves, whether that was in witchcraft or Christianity or their gender expression, through reading, and not necessarily something that was handed to them because they wanted that for them, but because they wanted them to read. So
yeah, it was awesome. And, you know, they weren't, it was interesting. My family, my parents were strictly anti-censorship. And although my grandma was very religious, she was very weird about censoring literature. She felt that was just that's a step too far. It was, she was fine not letting us watch The Simpsons at her house because it was evil. And she was weird about certain music. We had to stick to classical or Elvis. Dear God. But when it came to literature, she had the same mentality that seems everybody else in my family has, which is you cannot limit that for children, no matter what their age, no matter the content. I was allowed to read absolutely anything from any age, whether it was going to be like horrific, like the Scum Manifesto or Mein Kampf, or the Satanic Verses. I was allowed to read absolutely anything. Mm-hmm. So there was, they didn't have like a weird thing. It was more like, well, they had their own personal spiritual beliefs, but not having specific literature or denying literature, not a thing. We don't throw out books. We get overly attached in our family. So we all have pretty much mass libraries, me, my sisters, my cousins, my mom, my dad, it's my aunts and uncles. It's the thing. We get super attached and we pass them down to each other. So I've got books that just have family names going through them. Like my version of The Hobbit's just got my grandpa and then my uncle and then me, and soon it'll go to my nephews. And yeah, we're one of those families. So running across this literature and having access to it was with the full support of my family, whether they agreed with the content or not. They did not. They do not believe in censorship of literature.
Yeah. I mean, I think like what it is, both, it's a gift to grow up in a house full of books. You know, I think for anyone, that's a gift that your parents give you, whether they intend to or not. It's to grow up in a house full of books for your caretakers, if not your parents. And then I think the other thing is, you know, I see all these memes about like Gen X and elder millennials growing up. It's like, oh, you were reading Stephen King and B.C. Andrews probably when you shouldn't be, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, but like, I think it made us all, maybe it exposed us to ideas that we weren't ready for, maybe. But I think it also made us realize that you can make choices about those things. Like, you know, I don't still read Stephen King. I don't. You know, I read a lot of Stephen King as a kid. I don't really read him now, but I agree with you. I think there, as a parent, like we kind of let our son read whatever he wanted to read to you, and he's still a reader. And I think if you tell a child no around a book without giving them something, it's like, maybe not this one yet, but here, read this. You know, I think if you just say no, you either make them want to go find things in places that maybe they shouldn't look yet, or you just make them not read, which is such a tragedy.
I've noticed that for a lot of other friends I have that are my own age, where they had parents that did over censor. I had really young parents. My parents were Gen X. I was, you know, kid of two teenagers. And I'm the second too. So they were pretty young and they're real with it. But yeah, that was, I think it's because my parents did not make certain things taboo that they did not become things that I sought. So in my family, for example, use of marijuana, like back in the day, back in the 90s and 80s, that was not, I was never told that that was a drug. I was told that that was medication that people in my family take at night because they got annoying ass kids who don't shut up, or they got long ass jobs, or because of whatever, or if they have back problems or issues. I was always told that's, oh no, that's just medicine. And you don't take that because you're young and you don't need this medicine. There's nothing wrong with you. And so I didn't grow up like with like smoking through high school like a lot of kids did. It was like, oh, well, my parents wouldn't be weird about it, so what do I care? And my parents don't care what I watch for the most part or what I read. So I didn't seek to rebel. It wasn't disallowed, you know? Mm-hmm. But all the stuff that I was restricted from or told no to, absolutely I rebelled about. They were so weird about alcohol of all things. So what did I do at 15? Got sloshed and showed up to the house and got in trouble. Yeah. It's such a thing. If you tell a kid, if you get too much restriction, just too much, you're going to make it look tantalizing.
Yeah.
But give just enough leeway and a lot of context, which is what my parents did. They, before I would read something very controversial, my mom would be like, let me explain some things to you.
Yeah.
Especially when I got into reading about World War II and reading about the Holocaust from different perspectives too. Mm-hmm. Horrible, like just, it was just fascinating the amount of mental gymnastics people have done throughout history to deny such incredible atrocities.
Yeah.
We got to that unit in middle school and I wanted to read everything on the list. And I was so grateful that my parents were like, we're going to give you some context here. We're going to teach you, you know, what it is you're supposed to be looking for and take you to meet someone who is descended from people who survived the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Because you really need the context before you go into reading this. And I really appreciate that my parents were like, we're going to make sure you have a good education before we let you read something too controversial. Luckily, when my parents, you know, knew I was reading about witchcraft stuff, my mom was like, well, go for it. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Dad was like, oh, you know, Lord Jesus, forgive me, but okay. They're real cool about it.
That's good. Yeah. It's funny, like, just thinking about, like, as a parent, like, my son had to read Mouse in school.
Yeah.
And I think there were parents who were like, they're too young. They really don't need to. And it was like, you know, children were murdered in the Holocaust. Like, they weren't too young to experience it. Like, I think it's important that kids read about it. And I thought that choosing something like Mouse was really a way to introduce them to it by talking about the aftermath of the Holocaust more than like the, I mean, yes, there are parts of Mouse that do talk about what happened to his dad in the camps and all of that, but it's really about the impact it had on his family, about losing his mom, you know, all of that. And now, you know, he was in school in Tennessee when that happened. And then it was a school in Tennessee that banned Mouse because at some point, you know, there's Mouse boobies when she commits suicide or when she takes her own life. And I'm just like, you know, this is ridiculous. But yeah, I just think, you know, as a parent, I get wanting to some extent, wanting to shelter your children from the worst of things. And I don't think our job as parents is to toughen our kids up for the world. The world's going to do that on its own.
Yeah.
You don't need your parent to make you tough. But I just, you know, like the idea that you're going to protect them from ideas is so ridiculous to me. Like, yeah, like the minute you say no, that's where they go. Like for me, like it was funny, the inverse for me, my dad was like, if you guys want to drink, you can do it at home. And so my brother and I were never big drinkers because we were like, how much fun can it be if we can drink with dad? You know, like, it's just not, you know, it wasn't that interesting to me.
Yeah.
So, and I think it was the same thing with ideas and growing up in a house full of books. Like, I don't ever remember my mother or my father saying, you can't read that.
Yeah. Debate was really important in our household. Mm-hmm. We were from it's an adoption based family. It's extremely diverse religiously and racially and politically. And you can't get along in a family like that if you're not willing to understand where all sorts of people come from, all sorts of ways of thought, languages, religions. So I think it was really awesome that my family's idea of diversity was diversity of thought completely and politics. Mm-hmm. You need to learn how to empathize and sympathize with the people you most disagree with on any scale, whether it's religion or politics, because that person might wind up in your family. And just because they're different doesn't make them bad. It makes them different. And if they were like you, this world would be boring. I was taught that, you know, that kind of hegemony is like the most boring, depressing way to live, when everyone thinks like you and looks like you and has your language and speaks with your accent. There's nothing more boring to me than that. I don't want to live in a world where everything's the same. Yeah. I like being challenged. I like being around people who are constantly making me think about my absolutism and challenge my ego.
Yeah. That's such a powerful statement. So I'm curious, did you discuss this book with anybody in your family when you were reading it as a kid? Or did you just kind of absorb it?
Myself, you know, it just, they were very much disinterested. My parents are a lot more into politics. And I think, for me, this was just such a personal thing. Mm-hmm. My building of what folk witchcraft was going to look like for me with all these different influences in my life. I'm such a super independent, fully self-oriented person. I very much did not connect to my family when it comes to like really personal stuff. Everything from like romance and to friendships to my personal interests are very much things I actually keep very distant from my family. Mm-hmm. For us, I keep it about the family. But when it comes to this book, No, I didn't discuss it with anyone until probably, you know, when I started writing my book and I started doing more research or started the Viajadera blog. I started quoting Jules Michelet a lot because I was just, you know, such a big fangirl. And oh God, I had his quotes all over my MySpace page back in 2005. And oh yeah, geeked out. I never talked about it with my family much because it was just such a deeply personal, private journey for me, this particular one.
I know, I'm fascinated by him and kind of that whole, like, I think it was really interesting how they couched it that, you know, Leland and Murray both really reference him without ever citing him, which I think is funny. And also like partly part of the time, but also like, why did they not cite him?
Oh, easily because they both had real specious research, and famously so. They both have to be taken with a grain of salt. So it makes sense to me that they would also not want to really show where they are getting their ideas from when they're promoting them as in Margaret, in her case, she very much promoted this as like fact, that this was a real cult, that she had back, she had proof. And in order to bolster those claims, she wouldn't want to have to back that up with Jules Michelet, who has been questioned. You know, I could see that. Just quoting, using his work without quoting him or referencing him, but using his work would be a perfect way to promote this idea of this ancient witch cult, which they were both huge proponents of. And unfortunately, that led to the misunderstanding we had all the way up until I was probably a teenager, that Wicca was this ancient religion, the ancient goddess religion, you know, the Mist of Avalon and all that. And it really, you know, changed perception, that idea of this cult. And I think they wanted very much not to be questioned about that, which is why they had such questionable research methods. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I don't know. Like, Leland is such a cipher for me, because part of me thinks that it really was metaphor for him and it kind of got out of hand.
Yeah.
Like a little bit. And Murray, I'm more like, I think she wanted it to be real. She wanted so badly to be right.
Yes.
And
She was reaching desperately and conflating practices and drawing conclusions and drawing etymology. There's a lot of interesting ways they try to pin the etymology of words together to make it seem like there had been this wide cult across. And that's really unfortunate because, you know, a lot of Fraser's work is amazing. He has some great deep cut stuff in his work that can be backed up and found, that is really interesting research, especially some of the stuff that he pulls going back as far as Greece. He does some really interesting references in his work, but that you could tell in Murray's case, she very much wanted this hypothesis that she had to be true. And it was so popular and it got her so much popularity at the time that I could see why she ran with it.
Yeah.
Very unfortunate, though.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting too. They are not the first nor the last group of people who were, I mean, like, Michelet is highly respected for his History of France. Like, that is still considered a seminal work.
Definitely.
And, you know, like, it's interesting to me that these scholars, I mean, because Murray, as an Egyptologist, I mean, I don't think she's cited as much anymore, in part because she kind of is seen as slightly damaged by this other aspect of her scholarship, quotation marks. But like, I'm fascinated by scholars who have this very respected and, you know, cited, you know, and then kind of veer into the supernatural, witchcraft, you know, the occult. And like, I just wonder, is like, when you get so deep into a topic, do you then wonder, like, what else is going on? And I know, like, I know people today, scientists today, who, like, it personally in my life, who, like, you know, had government top secret clearance and they're into UFOs. You know, like, it's not unique to this generation that we're talking about, I guess.
Right. Oh my gosh, look at that kitty. Oh, sorry.
The podcat has appeared. So what, like, in addition to Michelet, like, who else would you say has impacted kind of your, like, that idea you began to form as a child? I mean, really, nine is the child.
You know, the work of Ginsberg, Night Battles and the Ecstasies, those mm-hmm. were hugely influential work. I got into those through the work of Jules Michelet, because once you get into one of these piles that's quoted by a lot of traditional witches, you'll find like the whole set. And there's this this golden set of historians who have talked about the witch trials of Europe. And Ginsberg is absolutely one of my favorites. Night Battles, huge book for me, hugely influential. Loved it. I didn't know a lot about what the supposed witch cults of Europe, a lot of that mythology or narrative was coming from. So that was fascinating. I'm a huge fan of him. Other than him, I'm very heavily influenced by the classics. Le Petit Albert, The Picatrix, The Three Books of Occult Philosophy, The Ars Goetia, you know, traditional demonology. But mostly my most cited resources are probably Southern, as in like the American South, folklorists, like the Brown Collection, Waylon Hand. I'm a huge fan of Tom Pete Cross, who did research about North Carolina witches and witchcraft and magic and occultism there. I have a huge collection of the books from the Journal of American Folklore, and I have a subscription to the Journal of American Folklore. And I like, you know, I own a sizable quantity either in digital or in print. And I think those are probably the places I usually go is these, you know, I prefer regional witchcraft, and I'm very focused on North American witchcraft and that of my ancestors as they all converged here at the beginning of colonization and settlement and displacement and slavery, all of which was a huge hand in, you know, getting someone like me here. So like I focus mostly on folklorists who studied the South, and because most of our folklore as it spread throughout the regions of the US, you know, it started in the South and started in New England. So studying New England magic and Southern, that's my primary focus. So I'd say like my favorites are the Frank C. Brown Collection, Waylon D. Hand. I love the works of Puckett and Zora Neale Hurston. I love anything that came out of early American study of magic and witchcraft. And those are usually my favorite authors.
Mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated. Like so many people I know who are into folkloric magic also have a hand in like the grimoire tradition. And it's so fascinating to me because you think they're really opposite, but they're really not.
No, they're not. You know, the works that are attributed to Marie Laveau in our American South have use of magical squares, the same magical squares that are found in the three books of occult philosophy from Agrippa, the planetary squares. And they were all disseminated through these chat books at the time, you know, like the Red Dragon, the Black Pullet, the Grimorium Verum, these different, these grimoires and magical books that had been condensed down to smaller little pamphlets that could be sold. Voodoo shops in, you know, the 17 and 1800s. And so this got disseminated widely throughout and became accessible to practitioners of hoodoo and voodoo. So you see a lot of these magical squares and these very strict Western high magic ceremonial traditionalist stuff occurring in folk magic very widely. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love the training
to you.
Fascinating. I love that you can never quite separate high and low magic and ceremonial and folk magic. They borrow too much from each other. Ceremonial magic borrows so much of low natural magic, herbalism, and the use of lapidaries and bestiaries that are very commonly used by folk witches. Stuff that, you know, we're just doing on the regular. Ceremonials need that. And for us folk witches, there's a lot of ceremonial and high magic that is absolutely useful, from Sator squares to the magical squares to the movements of the spheres and the study of astrological magic, which is some of my very favorite. I love the connection. They can never really be extracted from each other.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I'm continuing to be fascinated by like the like you can't pull a thread and not like unravel a sweater you did not expect to even touch.
Which is the best. I love going down rabbit holes. I derive all my power, I think, from curiosity. Like if I were to just plain old say where I think my quote unquote magical self or abilities come from, I think it's just curiosity. I think I just get such a thrill and such a power out of hearing what people think, reading what they thought, just connecting to people's very different personalities and perspectives of the world and collecting all that data and going, well, I wonder what'll work for me. You know, that's what magic is to me, is collecting all this magical data, whether it's high or low magic, whether it's ceremonial and folk, and then going, now, where can I make this fit for me? Because it's all about me. And that's why I'm the witch. Because I'm trying to make my life better and improve my odds and do everything that I want to do, because I'm a powerful being, just like the sorceress. And I'm the bride of desert and black despair, and all the trees bend to me. You know, that's the goal, at least.
Yeah, no kidding. So I guess kind of as we get toward the end of our conversation, like I want to bring it back to the book. So, and, you know, I realize there are things in your practice you probably don't want to share, but like, do you use the book as a working book for you, or is it inspiration?
Just inspiration. There have been certain quotes that I've actually implemented into prayers that I've used. But for the most part, it's just sheer inspiration. It's also a tool that I use to help describe what folk witchcraft can look like to some people. From a, just from his perspective, I opened my book with that, where I had different quotes from different authors going down about how they perceived or described a witch. And that's what I usually use him for, is a witch is described in so many terms. They can be anything. They could be anyone. They could be your grandma, your daughter. They could know they're a witch or not know they're a witch. They could be your son. They could be your uncle. They could be your grandpa. They could be that man in the forest. They could be that you know, quiet child that doesn't say a word. The witch could be anyone. And the power of witchcraft could derive, you know, from anything and appear at any time. There's a lot of different perspectives of witchcraft as something that happens to you. That's not even, it's not something that you choose for yourself.
Right.
You're not even seduced into it. It just, it happens to you. It's like a condition that you catch.
Right.
And I think because there's so many different ways to describe a witch. One of my favorites is the way that Jules has described the witch in his story. I think it's very accurate to the freedom loving rebel, the outsider, the other, the person who turns to witchcraft because they are happy to ride with the chaos. They are happy to work for themselves. They aren't following a doctrine or a dogma. That's not what they're here for. They're here to dance in the ecstasy and the freedom of magic. And I use a lot of, I use a lot of his quotes mostly as inspiration and as an explanation for people who ask, you know, what do you think of a folk witch is, or why are they doing what they do? And I say, well, this is why. Vengeance. Vengeance, power, freedom, the strength to stand on your own and be completely independent and say to hell with everybody else. And I feel like his story sort of does that in many places.
Yeah. I mean, I think it, you know, it pulls on a couple things I see in, you know, in ideas about modern witchcraft, about, you know, witchcraft is the tool of the oppressed. Like that really comes through in that story of her. And then even in the witch trial sections, I think it also comes through. And then I also so appreciate his discussion of what the witch has been made versus what she actually is.
Right.
And this idea of the hag, and, you know, and it's like, no, you know, the witch is beautiful. The witch is a source of her power. It's not. And, you know, and he says things that, like, terrible beauty, like it comes up so many times in the text. And I was like, yeah,
I love it. He's I feel like he had an appreciation for the wildness of what craft is and how it changes and transforms a person into a wild, free, flying thing. And I've that's hugely why I love the story and why I really wanted to talk about it with you is because I understand it is such flowery language and it is so old timey. But if I could really suggest to anybody who's interested in folk witchcraft, traditional witchcraft, and the origin of a lot of the perceptions and the narrative that we have of what witchery is as an act of rebellion, as a political tool, as a natural byproduct of having to almost like an immune response against depression and religiosity, I would strongly suggest that young readers and people who are interested in pursuing what witchcraft means in history, and from that perspective, really look into this version of the sorceress into the first half of the book, especially about this narrative. I think it will inspire a lot of people to feel seen. they might find themselves very seen in that character, because I know that I did. Even at 8, I felt very seen in this character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna say, if people are intimidated by the language, the first part really is so beautiful that though it is flowery and it takes a minute to kind of acclimate to it, it's totally worth it. I think for me, like the second part, like I probably got more out of Ginsberg than out of Michelet's telling.
Yeah.
Though there are fascinating things and there are a couple sections in there, especially I would be like, yeah, I'll read this. There's a part about the Sabbat and, you know, all that, but definitely read. But I think if you want more about the witch trials and their impact, Ginsberg is probably better.
Yes, absolutely. But, I would say Ginsberg. I mean, the Night Battles and the Ecstasies they hardline focus on this, and it doesn't involve the personal narrative or the poetic prose of a specific character, but you do get a lot of interesting names and figures that may or may not have existed. Fascinating history through Ginsberg. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say, just as a writer, like the second half of the book is like filled with plot bunnies. If you're a fiction author, there are so many plot bunnies in the second half of the book. Read it for that, if nothing else. So yeah. I'm so glad you chose this book. And like I said, I feel like I will probably read it again when my brain is less COVID addled, to just kind of get, you know, both more in tune with his language, but like I'm down my own rabbit hole with him now. It was funny because I was trying to find books that talked about his book, and that was how I found Satanism, a Reader, which I went ahead and bought because I was like, I know I'm going to read this whole book now because, you know, it's like, okay, here's another plot hole, another rabbit hole to go down. So yeah.
Absolutely. I just love it. He's also an introduction to my idea of the witch's Sabbath, because it was through Jules that I found Ginsberg, through Ginsberg that I found all the other works pertaining and started to find more about the Salem trials, the deep cut stuff about the Salem trials, not the stuff that's easily found, but surrounding Salem, stuff that took place in other parts of the country. Like Jules is a great doorway for folks. And I hope people can, you know, step through that and find something fascinating on the other side.
Yeah. And I will say, for people who want to read it, the book is in the public domain. So it's available on Gutenberg, but I also found a really nice clean copy for free on Apple Books.
Yep.
Like it's available widely for people to read for free. Ginsberg, not for free usually, but this book you can get for free.
Michelet, folks. Oh yeah. And you can get it in its original French. You can get it in a bunch of languages now. I think it's been translated into dozens of languages by now.
Yeah. It's curious because the English translation that is most widely available was almost contemporary to when he wrote it. I would be curious to see a more modern English translation of it.
Me too. I would be really fascinated. And I wish I spoke better French so I could do my own translating.
Yeah.
I lack that talent.
French speakers listening, we have a job for you.
French speakers listening. And also feel free to correct any of our pronunciation.
Yes, please. I'm
so sorry.
I really apologize to Parafonel or Faxnel. I'm not sure how he pronounces his name. I really apologize because that was the one I could not find any guidance anywhere online to get. So hopefully it's not murdered. Well, thank you. And let's definitely do this again. Out of curiosity, do you want to plug anything, or you got stuff coming up you want to talk about? This will air on the vernal equinox. So,
oh, that's awesome. Well, folks, you can look forward to seeing, I have some pieces coming out in Llewellyn's Witch's Almanac and in their calendar. One piece is about the blackberry spirit, and it's a practical piece. And another piece is about witch rabbits and rabbit witches in American folklore and our unique connection to each other. But other than that, folks, it has been such a pleasure. Victoria, thank you so much for having me. This has been absolutely wonderful. I love talking to fellow book readers, and I love that you're such a book fan, and I love your show, and I'm so happy to be on here.
Thank you. Thank you. And anytime you want to come back, let's do it.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenankar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.